Accession number 12376, real 2.
Mr. Simpson, real 2.
The Hudson was not nearly as good an aeroplane as the Dakota for supply dropping work, because the facilities for the disposal of the load was not as easy, and they couldn't carry nearly as much as we did. Repeating again, the weather was the big problem to us. People hadn't really flown through monsoons before, but we had to fly through them, because that's a fact of life. And the weather was absolutely atrocious. Cumulonimbus clouds stuffed into grey cloud. Didn't know where. We had no radar on board or anything like that. We didn't even know what radar was out there. And so it was just a matter of trial and error. And the maps were very inadequate. You'd go to a place and we'd try above and get down. We'd try going in on the treetops, and you'd go up a valley and find that the valley was closed by a cloud at the other end. You'd have to circle up and come out again and try. But our navigators were absolutely superb, because they modified the existing maps so that they could tell where you were. And so the team is very, very good team spirit, and within the squadron, we had people would go and find somewhere, and they'd come back and talk about it and how they got on. So we're passing information backwards and forwards.
What about the transfer from Basel on the northwest frontier in the northwest frontier province to Agatala, which I think is in eastern India?
That was a very interesting thing. Fatty was a great party man, and he used to go into Rawalpindi, and Flashman's was the bar where everybody went. And well remembered, I'd gone with Fatty to Flashman's, and the station adjutant came in in a state of great distress. I don't know how much you know about the signals, priorities, but the highest priority signal was an O break U, and there was only one person could send an O break U signal, and that was Louis. And he'd had an O break U signal from Louis that 194 Squadron will move to Agatala and be operational within 24 hours. We were. Fatty sobered up immediately and got it going, and we were on our way. And that was how it took place. And of course, the reason for that was the army situation in the Arakan. They were surrounded down there, and they needed supplying. And we went down to Agatala and were supplying them 24 hours later.
Do you remember when that was?
We moved on the 9th of February 1944. We flew from Basel to Allahabad, down to Camilla, and Camilla to Agatala. And we were operating on the 10th of February to a supply on the Arakan front. And that was, I think they called it the boxes. We were supplying the boxes down there. And we did that daily.
How did the airfield at Agatala compare with Basel to operate from?
Oh, they were similar airfield. They were, tarmac. Good morning. There's tarmac airfield, and the living quarters were not as good as we had. Brick buildings up at Basel and down there. They were just bamboo and thatch, but perfectly adequate.
And how were these operations into the Arakan mounted? What shape would they take?
Well, we would be given a load, given a dropping zone, and we would go down there and drop the load In that form, the device.
How? But what form was the load in?
What?
What form was the load in?
The load would be anything from food to ammunition to barbed wire. Anything they wanted, we would drop down there. The Rice Corps, the Royal Indian Army Service Corps, used to load up these airplanes, and we would just go out and drop whatever we were told. The loading procedures were haphazard in the extreme. I mean, we'd be told we've got 6,000 pounds of stuff, and you couldn't check it or whatever. I remember one occasion we were not down at the air camp, but we were taking sugar, and the sugar had been outside in the rain all night. So heaven knows what it was weighed, but dry weight was about 6,000 pounds, and been soaked up all that rain, and the Dakota would trundle down and away it would go. No problem. Wonderful.
Surely the sugar would have been ruined out in the rain.
Well, it was in sacks, hessian sacks, and it wasn't ruined, it was still sweet.
But partially dissolved, presumably.
Partially dissolved, but very heavy. But after the Arakan, they moved them all up to the siege of Imphal, and we moved the whole, I don't know, divisions or brigades or whatever they are, a lot of the army, including their 25 pounders. And that was a very important move because Imphal, as you know, was cut off, and we moved this. And the first time I took a 25 pounder on board, it's dismantled and stripped around, lashed down. And I said, well, where's the breech? And the breech is a massive thing, about 250 pounds. Oh, we put that right in the toilet. Right after the COG, and if you'd gone off and you move it out of there and put it up forward. That was the sort of, you had to keep your eyes and wits about you.
Because of the balance of the aircraft.
Due to the balance. The Dakota is a very flexible one. You can have the CFG within a torrent of about, 54 inches, which is a lot. But 250 pounds stuck right down in the tail would have been a bit too much for it.
Was there much difference supplying the Arakan from supplying Imphal?
Not really. They all wanted the same thing. They all wanted food and ammunition. And these were the loads that you took. Some of the things like flour and toilet rolls and so on, they just were a free drop. They didn't have a parachute. But then the other things, ammunition, of course, would be in containers with a parachute drop. And so that was really the only difference, the container aspect of it.
How much incoming fire did you have from the Japanese?
In the Arakan in particular, you see, we were flying right over the Jap lines, so we got a lot of trouble from small arms fire, because they were very good with their small arms fire. But you just had to ignore it and get on with it. The chap with whom I did the very first trip to the Arakan, Joe Curtis, he was a Canadian, and the trip after I flew with him, he had one engine put out by ground fire and had to complete his drop and then come back on one engine. But everybody was hit a little bit occasionally, but nothing very serious. We lost one or two airplanes down there. But
did you know the circumstances under which they'd been lost?
No, they just didn't return. They'd be. It's very difficult when you're down there and you're flying low, and suddenly the aircraft grows into the ground. You don't know why. May have been misjudgment. May have been arms fire. There was no court of inquiry. It was just a replacement aircraft and crew were requested.
Was there any danger from Japanese fighters?
Yes, there was indeed, but we soon developed a technique for dealing with them, particularly when you're low down. We stayed in the cloud as much as possible when we were up top, and then if we had to become visual below cloud, we got as low as we could to the ground. We had a chap called Watkins, and he had a very hazardous trip with the Zero, and he discovered that if you got down right on the treetops, and as you know, a fighter has got to, unless he gets to be in point blank range, he's got to do a deflection shot. He's got to fire in front of you, so he's going to be, if you're right on the, he's got to be aiming lower than you are, and that was the only the way to do it. Deal, get down so they couldn't fire, and then if you get close, then you just close one engine and do a very steep turn to get away from him. That was the only way. They did give us two Vickers gas operated machine guns pointing out the side, but they weren't very good.
Why not?
They had such a restricted range of fire, because the tailplane was down there and the wings were there. They just had a very little range of fire, just on the quarters.
How many times was your own plane attacked by Japanese fighters?
Never attacked by them. I was always very lucky.
Did you see Japanese fighters?
Oh yes, we saw them. Yes, because we used to get a lot of protection from RAF fighter squadrons. We couldn't see them, but they were keeping the Japs very busy. I met a chap when I first joined BOAC, and he was on a Hurricane squadron there, and they used to, he told me that they used to get up when the Dakotas were going in, they would be sweeping the area. And so we didn't get an awful lot of trouble. We had one chap shot down doing a landing on one of the jungle strips, Squadron Leader Bell, who was actually my flight commander. He was an Argentinian, and he was attacked as he was in his circuit into Aberdeen, one of the landing strips there. And he had a party of West Africans on board. And before they left, they were briefed how to take out the centre panel of the loading door. You undid four handles and then you moved it in, and then you were straight out. And these chaps were being shot up within the aircraft by this fighter, and he crash landed it onto the strip at Aberdeen. And as soon as they came to a stop, these West Africans, wonderful discipline, they had the door out and they were out with fixed bayonets looking for the people who were shooting at them. They hadn't appreciated that it was fighters, but their comrades were being shot up around them. They went out with fixed bayonets. I always thought that was a very fine example of discipline within the army.
What did you think your prospects were if you did come down in the jungle?
Oh, not very good.
Did you have any precautions for that? Any contingency?
Well, they gave us a silk map, and they gave us a panga, a knife, you know, a big chopping knife, and a compass, and that was about it. We used to fly in boots, which would be good for jungle walking. But apart from that, no, we just, there was nothing to do that you could do, really.
Did you have any kind of suicide pill in case you were captured?
No.
What did you think would be your fate if the Japanese did pick you up?
I suppose we didn't really think much about it. I think that if you're going to go on operations, you can't start thinking all the time about all the contingencies. You just know you're going to survive. And if you don't go on thinking that, then I think that the chances of survival are fewer. Nobody went around thinking that this is going to be my last flight or anything like that, and anything's going to happen to me. It happens to other people.
But did you have anybody in the squadron for whom the possibility of death or capture or wounding, for whom it got to them in terms of morale?
I don't think so. No. No. Nobody went what they call LMF. No.
Lack of moral fibre.
Lack of moral fibre. No, nobody. I think they just wouldn't have done it. Or Fatty would have weeded them out before that state arrived. It's interesting that we would dispatch paratroopers, we had learned to do those, and our gunners were called, trained as dispatchers, i.e. they were the ones that saw the parachutists were locked up and sent them out when we put the signal light on. And it was thought that it would be a good idea if they did a parachute jump themselves, just to know what the troops were experiencing. So it was arranged that they did a parachute course and did a jump themselves, and then they became quite objectionable in the mess, because they would turn up and say, "Get jumped, you lot, you don't know what it's all about." So we appealed to the CO and said, "We've had enough of these gunners of ours coming this superior nonsense, could we do a jump?" See? And so he arranged it, we could go and do a parachute course and do a jump ourselves, so we were on equal terms with our crew of people. And we had one chap, a Canadian fellow, he just could not get himself through the door. And he said, "Well, give me another circuit." He did that three times, but he just could not force himself through the door. And people said, "Well, he ought to be chucked out." But Fatty said, "He's got more guts than you bloody idiots that jumped." He knew he couldn't do it, but he asked three times to have another go. And he kept him on, and he was a perfectly good man. I thought that was very good judgment on Fatty's part. I don't know why he couldn't do it, but he wanted to do it, but he just couldn't make himself do it. I only went because the fellow in front of me went. I broke my back and that, but I did the rest of my I did all my tour having had a broken back. But
people nowadays who studied the Dakota or the history of the Dakota sometimes go into raptures about what a good aircraft it was.
If you ever want to give me a Christmas present, give me a Dakota. It's the most wonderful airplane. I've told my kids, save your pocket money and buy me a Dakota. It really was a dream of an airplane.
Because of reliability?
Absolutely. I flew 10 years in Dakotas, because I flew it in the RAF and I flew it in civil aviation. I never had any problems with it. Excuse me.
Was it easy to fly?
My pardon?
Was it easy to fly?
It was easy to do the simple things, you know, takeoffs and landings, in a form. But you had to be very careful to do good runs under all conditions. But once you, I suppose like all aeroplanes, once you've mastered it, it became very flexible. You could do, you see, we were landing on these jungle strips. I think my figures are right. They gave you a minimum of 900 yards. And that was cleared. But they often didn't clear all the trees at either end. And so you had to get over the trees, and then there was your 900 yards. So you had to get it down there, and we learned to be able to do very, very short landings. It's a Dakota. You could, it's stalled with a load on at about 60, 65 knots, and if you brought it in 1% above the stall, she was perfectly manoeuvrable. Once you cut the power, she stopped. And so this, I've forgotten the date now, but I did. When the Chindits were surrounded, they built a strip called Blackpool, which was near the Ndorji Lake, and we had to get in there to get them out and to rearm them. And it was all done in a great hurry. And we went over there, and I could see a lot of people, and they were touching down and not having enough runway and then opening up and going around again. And I said, I'm not going to do that. No way. Because, you know, starting off with a heavy load on and trying to pick up speed, and inevitably there are hills around. I said, I'm going to get down on the end of the runway. And so we were dragging it in, as I say, about 68 knots with his load on. And Feynman, you know, kite to safe. And just we got to the end of the runway, there was a damn great tree they'd left standing, so we had to get over that, and I plonked it down, and there was a tremendous crack, and the undercarriage on the port side collapsed, and immediately the airplanes burst into flames. So we were belting down the runway, and I was holding it up on the one wing wheel that we had left, and then the engine just swung off to the left, but cleared of the runway. And after the war, I met the chap who was in charge of building the strip at Blackpool. And I talked to him about this, and he said, well, what had happened was that they didn't clear the very end of the runway because the bulldozer broke down. And so they had left a big mound of earth right on the very end of the runway, where they didn't think anybody would touch down as near the end as that. And that's what I hit this big mound of earth, and which you couldn't see. Nighttime operation, by the way. This was a night operation. And as we came to a stop, the aircraft was getting hot by then. I was out through the roof, and the crew tried to get around the back, but the load had shifted and blocked the doorway from the cabin side, and I was out through the top. And then I suddenly remembered that we were carrying the troops' mail, and I said, oh my God, we got the mail on board. And that was on the back platform, flat platform at the back of the Dakota. So I said, give me a leg up. And we got up, and we got out these bags of mail and flung them down. And that had an interesting... Can you just wait? That had an interesting side issue to it. In 1946, when I was back in England, I walked into a pub in Cookham near Maidenhead, a pub called The Ferry, and there was our former army liaison officer. And in the Air Force, they called me Joe. He said, hello, Joe. Congratulations on your MC. I said, I've got no MC. Oh, he said, yes, you have. I put you in for it. And it was agreed by the general. I said, well, it got lost on the way because I never heard about it. And I said, well, what did you put me in for? He said, well, the army always felt very conscious of the fact that you chaps were supplying them and they couldn't do anything about saying thank you. And so we were instructed that if any unusual incident occurred, which... the Air Force had done something different, then they would put the name forward. And he said, when I heard that you popped back into the airplane, which was blazing, to get the mail, that's just what we wanted, you see. And so he put the name forward. And I didn't get the MC. But it's another side issue to that. My son, the eldest one, he studies all my war history. I went out to Australia once, and he'd bought a book called Chindit by Robert Rhode James. And in there, it said that there was another chap had taken mail out of the airplane. And he sort of tossed the book, and he said, Dad, I thought you said you got the mail out of that Dakota at Blackpool. I said, yes, I did. He said, well, it says here that another chap who got an MC for it. And so I said, well, that's not true. So I wrote to Robert Rhode James. I said, where did you get the information about the mail at Blackpool? He said, oh, I was there. So I said, right, I wrote to my crew member, and I said, you don't know why, just write down what happened at Blackpool that night. So they all wrote these stories, and I sent the copies to Robert Rhode James. I said, that doesn't tie in with your memory. And he came back and said, oh, we all make mistakes, don't we? But this chap that did get the MC, he didn't get the MC for that. He did, well deserved it. He was one of the RAF chaps who walked in with the Chindits as a liaison officer. A very nice chap. I met him at one of the Chindit reunions. I questioned him about that. I said, you're reported as getting the mail out of the airplane. Can you tell me where it was that you got it from? And he couldn't remember. And I said, well, I can tell you where it was. It was on the back step, back platform. Oh, he said, he hadn't. So I don't know quite what his story was, but it was interesting to me. But there's one of the things that the squadron, they talk about at reunions, that they felt that the army didn't say thank you. I've never told anybody else on the squadron, but the army liaison officer told me. A nice chap.
Any other Chindit memories that you've got that you were personally involved in?
Well, the amusing or not, the very first night of the Chindit invasion, I flew with Fatty Pearson as his co-pilot, and all we did there was a supply drop on Broadway. But leading up to that is quite interesting. The day of the landing, we were all moved up to the advanced field, and there was a big briefing room, and it had photographs all around the walls, and we were to designated which strip you were going to land at. There were two called Piccadilly and Broadway, and you had to learn what it looked like because you were only going to see it by night, and you learn the way routing in and learn the routing out. And we were all busy studying these things and committing them to memory and drawing them. And in walked Wing Commander Coles, an ex-metropolitan policeman who subsequently went on to be an Air Chief Marshal, very powerful personality. And he looked at me and said, what the bloody hell's going on here? You've got the names all wrong. Piccadilly should have been called Broadway, and Broadway should have been called Piccadilly. So we all threw up our hands in disgust and then had to start relearning all this thing. This is one of the typical cock-ups that they get in. Anyway,
so the names had just been transposed.
The names had just been transposed, and people then had to unlearn what they'd learned and relearn. And then I was designated to be a reserve crew, my first crew flight on the Dakota. And so we weren't doing anything. And then there was suddenly an urgent call, and I was called over. As you probably remember, Piccadilly was found to have been blocked with balks of timber, and so everybody went into Broadway. It was all concentrated on Broadway. And they'd had a signal which came back that they were desperately short of water. So I was to take water in. And they fitted a bowser, a little bowser, into the airplane and loaded up some 50-gallon drums of water, and off we went. Tickled pink that we were going to operate the first night of the landing. So this would be my first night landing in the Dakota. And we landed at Broadway long after